So today we are going to be diving into an important conversation with our guest, Desiree Tucker. She's a valued member of our Parent Joy Circle who brought this important topic to us. And so we're going to explore together the nuances of microaggressions in the school environment, the impact on Black children, and how we can work together to really create a safe space for our kids and a supportive educational environment. Join us as we navigate this crucial discussion.
Absolutely. And so before we get started, Desiree and Sharita, before we really jump into the thick of things, I'm just wondering, Desiree, could you help us? It may be something that we're all familiar with, but could you help us in our audience just break down for us what exactly we mean by microaggressions, particularly for our listeners? How do they differ from the more overt forms of racism or discrimination? More so for our listeners, Desiree.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here with you guys. When I think of microaggressions, and when I'm thinking of my children and what they're experiencing, it's subtle slights. It's not the overt, in-your-face racism that's so easily identified, that gets talked about all the time. But it's these subtle things that just keep cutting you over and over again. And very often we don't notice it. Our children don't notice it. And maybe later on you're sitting and thinking about it and it'll hit you. And we internalize it very often. Our children internalize it. So subtle slights, that's the best way I can kind of summarize it.
Okay. So Desiree, I do want to ask you, and maybe Sharita wants to ask, I'm sure we both have examples from our own children, let alone our professional lives.
But yeah, no, give right. Us,
yeah. Right. I mean, if we really are honest here, we want to talk about how we support our children. And we're very familiar with it and we can name it, but maybe our children might not be able to name it. So Desiree, give us a concrete example, right? Because a subtle slight might be, a subtle slight could be anything, but in this particular case, we're talking about microaggressions that are race-based. So racial slights or microaggressions towards our children or that our children experience. What's a concrete example that you could share with our listeners?
Mm-hmm. So, one that comes to mind, I was once volunteering in my son's elementary school classroom, and there happened to be a substitute that day. And there was a child there, child of color, and the substitute was going through names, calling out children's names on the list, children who were in the classroom. And she mispronounced this child's name. And she was corrected by not only the child, but other kids around this child. And she kept doing it. Every time she said this kid's name, she just could not get it right. And it got so bad, I mean, the kids were almost yelling out this child's name to this teacher, who just refused to pronounce this child's name correctly. So to me, that's a subtle slight. That's something that someone could say, that's not a big deal. She wasn't familiar. She was a substitute. She wasn't doing it on purpose. And as a child, you may think that same thing. Oh, she wasn't doing it on purpose. But it still made that child feel bad. It would make me feel bad. What's wrong with my name that you can get everybody else's name in here correct, but not mine, over and over and over again? So that's just one example that popped into my head.
Sure. And I mean, I think one of the things I think about, and I'm not sure which comedy show, but there was a sketch about that where it might have been Key and Peele, where the substitute teacher was calling, or the teacher, but I believe it was also
a
substitute.
It was a substitute from Detroit.
It was a substitute, right? Shout out to Detroit. And the students, I think it was on Key and Peele, and to what you're talking about, Desiree, was just totally, decimating these children's names. But what was funny is some of the names were like Brian in this skit, right? Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. because these were primarily a group of black students in the class, and the mm-hmm. teacher in the skit, I believe, was white, he would say something like, Brian, you know, it was just mm-hmm. like... Right. And, you know, they yeah. kept correcting him, this whole class of students. And he was, you know, I guess he was like, it just can't be Brian. So it has to be something yeah. else. And though it may have not been that simple in your example, you know, that skit was really emphasizing how often that happens in schools for children. Sharita, do you have one that maybe your daughters have shared with you or that you can relate?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And, you know, this is, and I wanted to say, oh, yes, absolutely. And I always struggle with like the topic of microaggressions, right? Because we talk about how it's subtle and then a person's might go back and sort of think about, did this happen? But I kind of think with that teacher, it was kind of intentional if you just doing it again and again. Like, was there any like apology, like, oops, I messed up again? Or was it just...
She did...
Like, you just gonna keep going.
Well, she did apologize, but you know, at some point, it just feels like you just don't care enough.
Right.
You don't see this right. child yeah. as important enough
yeah.
to even just, I mean, you know, whatever issue this teacher was having, make a note to yourself, mm-hmm. you know, phonetically spell it out, however it makes sense to you, so that you can get it right.
That's right. And that's right. And to your question, Valerie, I've had it happen a lot to my own daughter's names. I mean, who would get like Nia wrong, N-I-A?
Right.
Mm-hmm. And
right.
who would get Imani wrong? Yeah. And it's just a constant sort of mispronunciation and students having to sort of correct and, right. and no sort of recourse of, okay, I messed that up again, or I've done this, but it's the intentional skipping or shortening or nicknames of black or brown children with names that you cannot pronounce.
Sure.
Right.
Sure.
Right.
Sure.
And
sure.
So I've seen that, especially in like the elementary school context. Mm-hmm. And I'm just like, learn the name. Nobody wants to just be given a nickname and
right.
they're okay with it. And sometimes the nickname is given without even children accepting that nickname or without parents even knowing. So I've seen it in that context, and it's happened with my girls as well too.
Sure, sure. So I don't think yeah. any of us are immune to these microaggressions. So, you know, when we're thinking about right now, we're saying, talking about pronunciation of a name. And some of us are, if not all, are most parents are very intentional about the names that we give our children. Like, we're thoughtful. It's a process. Yeah. So whether it's because it's our favorite drink, it's our grandmother's name or our grandfather's name or a favorite character in a book, oftentimes we're very... you know, specific about why or intentional why we have those names, right? And then they're in schools most of their time, right? Because school is their job. Mm-hmm. School is the job yeah. of children, right? And I say that to my daughter all the time. Your job is to go to school and learn, right? As much as you can and ask questions. So when children are spending all that time in schools and they're experiencing, like, that's just one example of a microaggression, right? There are mm-hmm. other examples that I'm sure we'll give throughout this conversation, but you know, mm-hmm. what do we think, or Desiree, you know, with this being something that's really important for you to discuss and bringing it to our attention again, what does it, you know, what do you think this means for their academic performance and in the school environment when they're faced with these microaggressions over and over again?
I think it takes a toll, you know, and it's, and we talk a lot about mental health and the mental health of our children. And I think, you know, our generation, this generation, the kids who are in elementary school, middle school, high school now, we're certainly more so now than when I was a child, focusing on their mental health and mental well-being. And also after what we've all experienced with the pandemic. And so I think that is something that we have to pay attention to it, and we have to be very deliberate about helping them identify mm-hmm. and cope with their feelings about microaggressions and and how to process it.
And we also got to hold the teachers accountable as well, too.
Absolutely.
Right? I mean, because this is the important, because this is some of the work that me and Valerie do, right? The whole point of having conversations about
absolutely
race. We talk about it with our kids. You know, we in this. We do it, right? And the thing is, we do want to prepare our children, but these educational contexts in which there is a power dynamic.
Yeah.
And children are just there to learn, especially with our little kiddos, you know, hand being raised because they want to contribute to something and deliberately being sort of looked over.
Right.
We have to begin to have conversations about what's happening to them so they can name it. And it's something I think one of you all said earlier, it's about them even like naming it, like, you know, this is happening. I remember my, now the memories are coming back, you know, with my 17-year-old, 12-year-old. But I remember my daughter came home and she was in second grade and she just said to me, the teacher is always treating me different. No, she said something like, I just had a bad day at school because I'm not white.
Mm.
And I was like, well, what does that mean? And she was like, she's always treating the white kids like they don't get in trouble for the things I get in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Like we're doing the similar thing.
Right.
But she seems to always be nicer to them than me. And that's when I had a problem, but she couldn't articulate.
Yeah.
She couldn't say like what it was, but she just was like, I'm not white today. Mm-hmm. I'm just, and that really, so y'all know I cut up. It's, yeah,
right.
I went there and did what I had to do. Right.
As you should.
Right.
As I should, right. But I say that to say, you know, they have to have the language to articulate it. And I don't know if we created spaces, especially for our young kiddos or just even adolescents, to even have this discussion of what those things look like. Because again, the person can say, you know, they're not doing this or sort of downplay it. So.
Yeah, and I guess there are a couple things that I'm thinking about and is running through my head, right? Because, you know, on the one hand, as Sharita said, we both study Black children and girls. Sharita does girls primarily. I do girls and boys. But we look at racial identity, racial socialization in academic context and out-of-school context. And so, you know, we really do this work and we are surrounded by colleagues. But when you're a parent trying to figure this out, and even as Sharita said, even as a parent, We're still parents. We're still human. Our children still encounter these things.
Mm-hmm.
Though this is what I study and this is what she studies. So, you know, Desiree, thanks for bringing this around. And I know some of our earlier guests, you know, were really beginning to have this conversation around, you know, racial socialization and supports mm-hmm. for adolescents. But even as was just mentioned in both examples, it starts as early, well, we know as preschool. You know,
that's right.
From some of our colleagues' work, like Margaret Beale Spencer, but definitely, you know, in elementary school, it's happening, and the children are able to feel it.
Feel
the differences mm-hmm. in how they're being treated. In both examples, you know, your daughters, and then the young man who just felt so bad about, you know, his name being butchered, but they may not.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, how do we do that?
And how do we do it and even have the conversations early, but then the educators, the administrators mm-hmm. in a building.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because we have some folks in society that really believe that race is not a topic or a conversation in the lives of kids.
Yes. Listen, we have professional colleagues.
They are adults. You know, they are grown adults. As my daughter says in their big age, people believe these things.
Yeah.
Right. And so
or disbelieve. Right. They disbelieve. Right.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so even in thinking about it, what can school administrators and educators do in addition to what Valerie said, like we preparing the kiddos, helping them sort of have the language or even to communicate so we could be able to be there and advocate for them. But what can educators and school administrators do to address and minimize the effects on Black students, even the recognition of it, especially in our kids in predominantly white schools.
Right. You know, I think it starts with they need to acknowledge it's a problem and call it out. You know, it has to be recognized, acknowledged, and accepted. And, you know, before mm-hmm. before we even can begin to get anywhere, because making our kids feel like, oh, it's no big deal, I was only joking, you know, you're being sensitive, is where it starts. Mm-hmm. You know, it really starts there, because
yes.
What was you about to say, Valerie? We so hyped up about this conversation. What was you about to say?
I was like, oh, it's such a soapbox for all of us. I do think it's a conversation, but first of all, I think they even need the language, right? What we know is that, like, we have a couple colleagues, and I know Allie Michaels does some work around, like, some measurement work around, and also Keisha Bentley Edwards has done some measurement work around, you know, white racial socialization. So not just this idea of unpacking, you know, the knapsack by Peggy McIntosh, but like literally measuring and quantifying. And what we know is that we know right now about 82% of the teachers are white females. Most of them are not living in the communities where they're serving. Mm-hmm. And what the research demonstrates is that, you know, they're taught to not see color. Now, how much that many of them are taught, the white racial socialization process is to not see color. Now, on the opposite, the black racial socialization process, which is varied based on your geography, your ethnic identity.
We
talk about that. But in general, black parents, for the most part, what we see in black caregivers are going to provide a racial socialization that deals with confronting racism, with confronting being treated differently because of the color of your skin. Mm-hmm. White racial socialization, and we're just saying this in practical terms, right? They're going to say, everybody's equal. No one's treated differently. I don't see color, right? So what that means is that they also need to have the language to identify it, to recognize it, and what it looks like in school environments. Not just when you go to the supermarket, not just what you see on TV, but what does this look like in my school community? And part of doing that, I would say, what I advocate for when I'm sort of writing for my peers, I always say we got to have some research next steps and some practical next steps. So I would say, they've got to get the language. So that might mean that you all need to have a professional development series, not just one, right?
Yes.
And so there's like a whole series, period. Like there's a whole organization or two or three by now that does, like there's an undoing racism, right? Where it's all about identifying, you know, big and small microaggressions, right? Yeah. So they need the language and the definitions, and then they need the examples. Like Desiree, I said, give me an example. Like, let's not just kind of skim the top. What does this look like when a little, you know, when our children are in school? And so I think one thing that administrators and teachers can do, particularly administrators who control the purse strings or the school boards who make decisions, particularly in predominantly white communities where our children are minoritized, they can say, we are going to bring in a professional development series. Not a one and done, not just a listening session, but we're going to like select a book about this or several books, or we're definitely going to have a series of workshops and training so we can really get into this. And that's, you know, it has been rare. Like there's some organizations that are doing that work. There's some school districts that are doing that work. I think about, you know, the work, you know, on advisory board of the Center for Black Educator Development. And through the Black Lives Matter process, there are some school districts who have decided to tackle equity and not just a once-off. Like, they're working with these whole districts. So this is an administrative level where they're saying, we're training these teachers in this particular way. So I think that's like, huge. And to me, it's a relatively low-hanging fruit in terms of making it happen. Now, changing the attitudes of all the school administrators and teachers, that might not be as easy, but being able to say that I'm going to dedicate some of my resources for professional development to this topic, that's low-hanging fruit, in my opinion. And I'm saying that as a mother.
You mean, right. Oh, exactly. I was saying, are you going to do that? You said it's low-hanging fruit.
I mean, I'll do it. Call me up. I will do it, right? But I'm saying, in terms of administrators who are saying, I don't know where to start. What to do?
Yeah,
how are we going to make this happen?
I agree.
Almost all schools, whether they are in disenfranchised disenfranchised communities, or whether they're in well-to-do communities, they have money for professional development. They have continuing education credits are required.
That's right.
And administrators, maybe with their leadership team, like lead teachers and content leaders, may set the calendar for what the professional development is going to be, but there's definitely a budget for it. So maybe one school district has $5,000 for the year. Maybe another school district has $50,000 or $100,000 or $200,000 for professional development. But indeed, continuing education is a requirement for teachers, and there are professional development budgets. So to me,
Yes. I think they could. And it speaks to the policies too. Sometimes folks think that if they take that one cultural competency class, they set for life.
That's it.
Right. They done. Mm-hmm. They did all what they need to do. And you speak about the continuity and the investment in CEU and just continuous professional development opportunities. Should be mandated. That's what we need.
I love that you said series. I mean, you know, and I'm bringing up the pandemic again because my kids were home. So I learned so much about, you know, kind of what goes on in their days. I got to see it. But, you know, things that I had forgotten, of course, it's been a long time since I've been a little kid in school. But, you know, learning in school is all about repetition. And, you know, I kept being amazed at, wow, we're doing this again. Didn't we just do this 2 days ago? And we're doing this again. Didn't we just do this last week? And I think the same can be said of training for adults. You know, it has to be drilled. It has to be something practiced. It has to be something learned over and over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It does. And it does. And a couple things I would say in relation to that, right, is, you have to, and you started to say this, Desiree, this is my favorite statement when I'm doing equity training or whatever, you know, the term evolves all the time, but is you have to get comfortable being uncomfortable, especially if this is not a conversation you had at your dinner table. This is not a conversation you have with your friends and your colleagues and your nuclear home growing up. You have got to get comfortable being uncomfortable because some things are going to come up. And in order to better serve the families and the children, because if you're serving the children, you are indeed serving their families, you must get uncomfortable, right? You got to get comfortable saying, this is not feeling good to me, and I'm addressing this. And then when we think about, like, classrooms and assessment and evaluation, right? Their peer evaluations of teachers and classroom evaluations, oftentimes they're checklists. So when we think about what are some easy ways that even teachers, individual teachers can do, or what individual schools can do. So let's say you have a principal or lead teachers who say, we want to do something different, you know, and we don't have the central leadership or the money. One of the things that is common for evaluation is like a checklist, a classroom checklist, right? There are these checklists that they'll say, are there enough chalkboards or, you know, one-to-one tablets, depending on what the instruction is? Are there enough desks? Are there like learning centers, particularly for early education, right?
That's right.
You can also say, is there diversity in the images around this classroom? You can add that, right? Or the teacher can add that to the principal or that leadership team. Is there diversity in the images? We know the book bans are happening, but is there diversity in the books, right?
That's right.
Like all these spaces where there are opportunities for small opportunities for diversity, you know, as well as large ones, which is why I say there's some low hanging fruit. And the other thing I would say is if you're not sure how to do it, what the approach is, call on those folks who do it. They're professionals. Right. They're researchers who do this all the time.
That's right.
Some, you know, who do this and can say, here's some best practices. You know, here's how this works. This is what it looks like. And also listen to the students.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Bring those students together and let them tell you how they are feeling. Right. And you might need to also bring the parents in there. You know, we did some work my colleagues and I at University of Virginia, we did some work during COVID to look at how school districts, entire school districts, were approaching equity and out-of-school time. And it was a Wallace Foundation-funded project. And it was an interesting experience because I started out in after-school time. Let me be clear. I worked in after-school time. I was an after-school facilitator, educator, program director, you name it, in out-of-school time. And so I said, well, wow, this is great, because I felt like this is the space where we can dig into equity if it can't happen during the regular school day. Well, what we found is that these districts had great equity statements, right? So that was our first benchmark. Let's see who has these great equity statements, common indicators of equity. Then we had interviews with those districts, and we were just finding that not only was there was a disconnect between the school day equity and the after-school equity, there was sometimes a common understanding of the definition, right, or what our mission statement is around equity, but not what it looked like in practice, right? So I can tell you what my equity statement is for my district, and your district, Desiree, may have an equity statement. But, okay, so can you tell me what this looks like in your classroom?
Can you tell me what this looks like
in your out-of-school space? And then you ask someone else the same question. So some districts, they were great. They were like, this is the statement. This is what it looks like in out of school. And this matches up with the school day. But then there were other districts who were like, this is what we do in out of school. But I'm really not quite sure if this looks like the school day equity efforts. So that alignment, that, you know, moving beyond just the surface of saying we've got a statement to saying this is what this statement looks like in action. Right. And so if we're saying this is a whole district effort, then your checklist should include some of those equity indicators that are reflective of your equity statement, right? That's like, that's easy, right? That's relatively easy. That's
very easy.
So, I mean, I want to move the conversation a little bit, right? Because this is such a tough conversation and intimate in some ways because we experience it. I'm wondering, you know, society has a lot to do with these stereotypes that are in our classrooms, and how teachers and administrators support or not our students. So how might we dismantle these harmful narratives and create safer spaces in schools when we know a lot of these narratives and stereotypes come from other spaces, other social spaces in our society?
You know, what are the things
I do with this stereotype?
Yeah, and so I only can, like, give, like, this example as just, you know, with the work that I do. And so I do go around to different school districts. And I present statistics and make sure, because every time I start off, I'm always like, I want to make sure that you all have the same knowledge I have around stereotypes and how they form in societal attitudes about children of color. And I give it to them. And people are like, they didn't know. Why did they know that Black children are viewed older than what they are? What is adultification? They never even heard of that term before. Why are Black boys criminalized in ways? It is an eye opener for people. But it gets back to what you just said, Valerie. People are very, very uncomfortable. So I start there. And then we just sort of dismantle the narratives. And then we even, I mean, it's even been so far that school district put out their discipline data after I was done with them. Okay. And began to just start looking at things. And so for me, I start with, this is how society has viewed Black children. And this is how they've shown up in these educational spaces. This is how they show up in your school. This is what some of your data says. And it's shocking and uncomfortable for people. But it starts a conversation.
Absolutely. And I have to agree with you because, you know, I had in Northern Virginia, I had did a workshop, like an introductory workshop to, like, you know, the diversity association. For that district, very diverse district, because it's in Northern Virginia, so you have international diversity, languages, over 50 language differences, within group differences, language, you know, you just name it, spiritual foundations, religious foundations. So we did this workshop, and it was primarily children and families of color, many Black, I would say the diaspora, and some non-Black.
So I do this workshop. I'm going through these steps of how do you identify it? What is racial socialization? How students experience it. This is for mostly the high school students, the high schools in this district. And there was one woman and her son, and she was, you know, and some of the board members were there. These were diverse members of the board. They were getting ready to vote, so they were looking to make sure they had representation on the school board. And this young man, high school student, he said he was walking home from school. He was of African descent, so I'm not sure exactly where, but definitely of African descent.
Mm-hmm.
And his mom is there, right? This is a group. This is like over 300 people I'm presenting to. Got the PowerPoint. And this little boy said, I'm going to call him little because my heart, my soul was not at ease. He was a teenager. He said, you know, he's walking home doing his thing. He walks past an older white gentleman. And the mom was saying when her son got home, she knew he was upset. This is that language you were seeing. How do you have these conversations with your young people, your children specifically? Sure. And then teachers, how do you have these conversations in school when they're uncomfortable, which is what Desiree is saying. This little boy, she could tell you were just volunteering, but you could tell he was uncomfortable. Yeah. How do we give them the space to name it when it happens? So she said eventually she got her son to tell the story, and she asked him to tell him. He was brave because it's like 200-300 people, mostly parents, some school board members, some teachers like from the and some counselors, high school guidance counselors. And he said hi to this man walking home from school, and he spit on him.
Hmm.
He said, and he didn't know what to do. This older white male. It was a black young man, like I said, phenotypically, and I know he was of African descent. He was walking home. You know, you greet, and that could be cultural. Like, and I remember even for me when I was a child, my dad used to speak to people. I'm like, Dad, you know them? Because my father's from the South. I was like, you're speaking to strangers, right? But he said he spoke to the gentleman, older gentleman, and that gentleman spit on him.
Oh. Wow. Isn't that?
And there were clearly racial tensions in this district. It has made national news several times for all of these kinds of issues and these microaggressions that we're experiencing. And so he didn't want to tell his mom, and he didn't know, you know, and he didn't want to say that it was race, like it was race-based, right? This assault that he's experienced. But, he said he was questioning, what's wrong with me that this old man spit on me and all I did was say hi? Right, so that processing,
Yeah, you know, that, you know, one of the things that I push with my kids, and they are both in elementary school, is coming home every day and talking to me. And I ask them, I have to figure out ways sometimes to pull the information out. But it's important that I know what went on in their day. Because as we were saying earlier, you know, they spend the majority of their time in school, in these environments, with people that don't always look like them, that don't always have their best interests in mind. And so I have to ask the questions. I have to be involved and care about what has gone on in their day and really listen to them.
Well, that's right. How do you get them to do that, right? So, you know, your children a little younger. How do you get them to, like, if a parent said, well, my child doesn't want to tell me about their day, you know? Like,
right, so can I add on to that? Okay. Can I add on? In addition to the different personalities, like, I have two kids. One is baby chatty, will chat you all day. We'll just talk. The other one is like, hey, how was school today? The same as it was the past couple of days. Right? And that's it. So how are you pulling conversation or any tips on, you know, because it's different personalities or just engaging in those conversations? I just want to add a little bit to what you said, Valerie, because I was just thinking about it. And I'm like, because, you know, especially teenagers, they're different, or even a young kid.
Absolutely.
Well,
yep.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep.
So, you know, that's something that I really found myself, as especially my son was getting older, struggling with. You know, I was getting the same kind of, I couldn't just ask, so how was your day? Because he used to come home as a little one and wanted to just tell me everything. And then, you know, as we're moving into kind of the teenage years, he starts clamming up. Oh, you know, it was the same. Nothing, you know, nothing happened. And I looked online to find suggestions on, you know, how can you engage your children? How can you get them to engage with you, to have conversations, to get information that will help you support them? And one of the things that I found was asking them, you know, what people usually call it is your thorn and your rose. And my kids are little, and I thought thorn, just they may not get that. So I changed it to onion and rose. And every day when they come home, what was your, and it sounds funny to them as well. You know, what was your onion for today? And they have to give me something. And what was your rose? And it's something that we do every day. Now I may have to change up my strategy once my son, you know, moves into middle school, high school, once they get a little bit older. But for now, that's what's working. And it's just a little tidbit. It's not always, you know, the best. Sometimes it's, you know, oh, you know, my onion today is that I have homework, you know, so, but it's still a tradition and something that I have kept going with them. And it's something that they have come to expect. And I expect an answer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's just one way.
I like that.
Yeah.
I like that. So now we get to some of our kids are in these spaces. We've talked about, you know, the prevalence of microaggressions in school, like the stereotypes, the actions. We provided examples. Now let's talk about solutions. When we think about Black kids surviving in schools, like they can survive, but how do we also ensure that they thrive as well too? Right? Not only surviving, just getting through it, getting through the day, getting through an educational system. But some of our kids can do that, but their soul is destroyed by sort of what has happened to them. What does it mean to survive and thrive in these spaces in the context of microaggressions? What do y'all think? I think about being healthy holistically, happy, identities affirmed. I'm not sure. What did you want to say, Desiree?
You know, I think we as parents, you know, again, I keep going back to, we have to know what's going on with them, what's going on in the classroom. I think we have to be involved as much as we can. We're all busy. Many of us work outside the home, not just one job, two jobs. Many of us are single parents as well. And finding the time can really be a challenge and, you know, a hindrance. And you're tired. And, you know, that's one more thing. You know, you may have just been dealing with racism yourself all day at work. And to then have your child come home and tell you that someone spit on them on the streets, you know, I mean, can just be, just take every little last bit that you got and you know, if you feel like you just have nothing else to give. So, you know, we have to, when you talk about holistic, we have to take care of ourselves as parents.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that we can take care of our children and recognize when we need help. We also have to learn how to depend on our parent joy circle, our fellow mothers and fathers and grandparents, and get them involved and get backup when needed. Depend on our village as well.
Surviving, so Black children not only survive in Valerie, but also thriving in educational spaces.
Ooh,
yeah, right. That's right. Mm-hmm. We do. Yeah. Sure.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
That's it.
Right.
That's it.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. That's it. That's right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, I love it. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. Yeah.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's okay. That's okay. Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. I love it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But check out the bag. Yeah. Listen, that's A. That's mm-hmm. the first best point. That's number one for me.
Right.
I mean, it was just necessary. It was just necessary. Mm-hmm. And then the education came after. Yeah, so I think this is wonderful. And the importance of like kinship and extended family. And the fact that we have to help our children navigate this, but we got to hold systems accountable.
Yes.
We have to and create space for them. So Desiree, mm-hmm. did you want to say anything before we wind down? Just add some additional? We had such a great conversation. We talked about everything. So it may not even be, but I'm just saying, what do you
think? I think we covered a lot, and I'm so glad that we did have the conversation. I think it's an important one, and you know, it's one that I am certainly on top of with my own children and with my circle, and trying desperately to do more so that our kids don't end up internalizing all of this.
Yeah.
And it, you know, because it will show up later on, it will show up now, and we want to help them thrive, as you said, and be the best people that
that's right
they can. And so that's it.
Well, thank you so much. This was wonderful, you all. So we want to extend our sincerest gratitude to our guest, Desiree Tucker, for your invaluable insights and contributions to this conversation.
Thank you both.